Hello and welcome to this emergency edition, in fact, national emergency edition of the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we got word this afternoon that President Trump plans to declare a national emergency in order to build a wall at the southern border. And I'm just going to read a statement from Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders in order to give us some idea of what we know so far. The statement reads, quote, President Trump will sign the government funding bill, and as he has stated before, he will also take other executive action, including a national emergency, to ensure we stop the national security and humanitarian crisis at the border. The president is once again delivering on his promise to build the wall, protect the border, and secure our great country. All right, so here with me to react to that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
So this is an emergency podcast.
It's a national emergency podcast.
And it's emergency national emergency
podcast. It's an emergency national emergency podcast. And also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going, Claire?
It's good, Galen.
And on the phone with us is 538 contributor and legal reporter Amelia Thompson DuVaux. Hey, Amelia, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Hopefully you'll be able to explain to us whether or not this is legal.
I would really not hold out on me to be able to explain that.
With just 2 hours of preparation, no. But before we get your reactions, let me also say that we recorded a podcast earlier today about the bipartisan deal that we expected to be voted on and potentially signed into law tomorrow. That's a conversation I had with Vox.com reporter Daryl Lind, who covers immigration. We are going to air that conversation right after our emergency reaction podcast because a lot of what we talked about with regards to what's in that bill is still relevant because it seems like that bill is still making its way through Congress and to the president's desk. But, you know, never say die. We will see what happens. And with that, Nate, give us what you got. What is going on here? Why are we in national emergency territory?
Because the president isn't good at politics, and the president overrates the importance of the whiniest elements of his base and neglected the fact that, like, we just went through this a few weeks ago, and you saw his approval rating decline while I have this kind of somewhat fruitless strategy to shut down the government for the border wall. The shutdown ends, his approval ratings begin to go up again. The base is loyal, which means it stays with him, and he has to think about, like, not what Ann Coulter or Sean Hannity think, but like what independent voters think, because they're the ones that will determine if he becomes a one-term president or not. I mean, it's really kind of not that, it's not that complicated.
It's sort of Shakespearean, though, isn't it? Right?
A little bit.
The man is brought down, like the man could potentially be brought down by his obsession with this one thing that did a good thing for him once.
It is Shakespearean. I agree.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we say
that's my take. I'm not going to say anything else the whole podcast,
okay.
Galen.
Thanks for listening to the 538 podcast. Leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Five stars, please.
You say that.
Or at least four.
At least four. Yeah, that was maybe a four-star review.
No, five.
Okay. But you say that this could bring him down. Do we know how popular or unpopular declaring a national emergency around the border wall is?
Never been done.
No. True.
You never know until you try.
In theory, according to the
polls. Generally, it's polling at about 33-ish% favorable, 58-60% unfavorable. So it's like, it's quite unpopular. Like, it's almost like 2-1, 60-30. Whereas, like, other things he's done, like, the shutdown was unpopular and the wall is unpopular, but this is, like, the most unpopular permutation of things that you could do.
Okay, let's get Amelia in on this, so we know it's unpopular. Amelia, is it legal?
I guess we'll find out. I mean, this is
okay,
a situation.
Leave us a rating or
leave us a rating of you.
Stay tuned, guys,
okay,
for potentially
Amelia.
Many, many, many months while this works its way through the legal system. I mean, so there are going to be legal challenges to this, absolutely, I think, from a lot of different angles. The issue is that Congress has given the president very expansive powers when it comes to national emergencies, and there isn't really sort of requirement about what constitutes an emergency. So the question for the courts is kind of going to be, at least one question for them is going to be, is this actually an emergency? And is that a question they even want to engage with? Like, are they going to question whether the fact that, you know, Trump presumably could have declared this emergency a long time ago and chose not to and now seems to be doing it pretty clearly because he can't get this policy agenda through, that could plausibly undermine his legal case, but the courts also might just, you know, not want to question the president's ability to determine what an emergency is. So I think it's pretty unclear right now, but there's certainly a plausible scenario in which this does turn out to be legal.
So the laws that we have surrounding national emergencies, they're just like not that specific about when you can declare one? Is it really just generally up to the president?
Yeah, I mean, it gives the president pretty much free discretion to announce an emergency, and they don't have any like requirements for what an emergency is. And, you know, there is a kind of escape valve for this. Congress did give itself the ability to cut off an emergency declaration. So I guess we'll have to see if that happens. It seems probably like it's not going to. But yeah, this is an area where Congress has really given the president a lot of power. And, you know, past presidents just haven't tried to use it in this way. So we haven't found out how far that power extends.
Well, it sounds like that escape valve with Congress is a political question. So how does this play out politically, right? Didn't we hear that Republicans didn't want this, that Mitch McConnell was pushing against this?
Yeah, and I guess Mitch was like, either it's going to be a shutdown or a national emergency. And those are two really unpalatable choices. By the way, I slightly underestimated how unpopular it was. I'm looking at the actual data now, not just winging it. And it's in the mid to high 60s, the opposition, not the high 50s, low 60s. Not a huge difference, but it's like, this is very unpopular.
Always
even for like,
check yourself.
I mean, it might become like a little bit more popular just because like some Trump loyalists will come along and things kind of tend to gravitate toward that 41-55 ordinary unpopular that he has about almost everything he does. But like, but you've already seen very mixed reaction, you know, among the GOP. Our friend of the pod, Marco Rubio, who we thought would win the 2016 nomination, come out.
You did.
Okay, not friend of the pod. Friend of incorrectly calling the 2016 Republican primary, Marco Rubio, came out and said, doesn't think it's a good idea to do it this way. Collins is against it, not too big a surprise. Ron Johnson is against it. Lindsey Graham, very enthusiastic about it, it sounds like. Mark Meadows, House Freedom Caucus chairman, fully supports it. So anytime you're creating a divide within your party, that's not great, right? Because again, this is Axios, friends of the pod. Axios has 6 Republican senators speaking out against it, which is probably a selected sample, right? These are people who you would expect to have an opposition to it, and they do. But like, you know, there are also various mechanisms that the other panelists might know more about where you can actually have Congress try and nullify the declaration. I believe it would have to overcome at some point a presidential veto. So it can become relevant whether you would have a 2/3 majority in the Senate to override the president's veto of the nullification of the emergency declaration or lack of authorization for it, I guess. So that could become relevant at some point. I mean, I don't know.
Could this become more popular over time?
It probably will a little bit, but like just kind of, you know, it just kind of strikes people the wrong way. And you're going to have like objections from, you know, people in the military, for example, who were a bit like, okay, this is taking money budgeted for other things. It's not a ton of money, but like it's going to affect some other priorities for the military. You're going to hear a fair amount of objections from Republicans themselves. I mean, McConnell had said this was a bad idea. Democrats are kind of split already between the ones that are saying this is terrible, the ones that are saying this is great, because now when we get President Klobuchar, you know, she and Vice President Harris or whatever can like declare all the emergencies they want. So you see a split with Democrats and how they're handling it too. So I don't know. It kind of reopens an issue that had gone badly for Trump before, and like he's just kind of tried everything here in the like least possible effective way so far. And he like doesn't seem to be learning like any lessons. Like the whole reason that they're your base is because they're loyal to you. And you could shoot someone proverbially on Fifth Avenue and probably with a few of them get away with it because like they're loyal to you. We've done so many things to earn their loyalty over time that like you have to like occasionally buck them to try and regain your standing among independents.
All right, Claire, so if that's how Republicans feel, what do Democrats do now? They were ready to pass this bill.
Yeah, I think you have to...
I mean, it passed the House, or
right.
The Senate, excuse me.
It's separate issues almost, right? Like, because he can just declare the national emergency, and they still don't want a shutdown.
Is there any incentive now to be like, okay, well, we were going to pass this before you decided to declare a national emergency. Now we don't want to do that because you've Bigfooted everything. Are all of our negotiations, which was about the wall, you were just like, ah, it doesn't matter anyway. I'm going to build it with a national emergency.
So here's my question. If they decide to shut down the government again, is it still, as the last shutdown was, Trump's shutdown, trademark caught on tape? Or does it become like shared responsibility and therefore shared political liability for Democrats and Republicans?
I mean, I don't think another shutdown is in the set of possible outcomes now. I mean, this bill did pass the Senate like with 82 votes or something like that. Democrats were
after it was clear that a national emergency was going to be declared.
After. So, but like, you know, there have been some polling saying because Democrats were starting to make more demands. So we have to like reduce the number of detention bins that ICE has access to. So like, it's possible that if like you had another shutdown and they were really, really drawing a line that was like, okay, we're not going to give you any money and you have to reduce the number. I mean, it's possible the politics would have played out like a little differently. I don't think they would have been a lot different. You know, again, Trump basically conceded to Pelosi and the sky didn't fall. And, you know, and by the way, some of the people who's trying to placate, is it placate or it's placate, right?
Yeah.
It's been a long day. I feel like it should be placate, but I know it's placate.
Well, okay, go ahead.
Church Latin versus classical Latin pronunciations
yeah.
here.
But like some of the people are like, you know, we actually were opposed to this deal. We may or may not like this emergency declaration anyway. I mean, I don't know. He's so narrowly minded and focused about like we have to prove that you fight for the base. But again, like that's baked in now. That's baked in. The base isn't going to abandon you. The base didn't abandon him during the shutdown. Didn't change like nothing. If you look at like Gallup rating for Trump among Republicans, it is always 88%. It doesn't matter what he does, right? Whereas the independent numbers swing up and down a lot and affect his overall approval rating, therefore.
All right, Amelia, so with regards to what the Democrats in Congress can or will do next, where do they go from here in terms of what power Pelosi has in the House, what kind of lawsuits or investigations they can do?
Well, they can try to file a lawsuit, and I think they probably will. I think there are some questions about whether that's something they can do that have to do with sort of nitty-gritty legal questions about who can bring lawsuits. Yeah, Nate is right that, you know, canceling this or terminating it is going to require veto-proof majorities in both houses. So, I mean, there's not so much to do beyond taking this to court. And this is going to take a very long time to resolve because what we saw with the travel ban was that, you know, it got fast tracked because there, you know, there were people who were trying to get into the country and couldn't. And so it was an urgent matter. And I mean, obviously hard to exactly say what's going to happen, but this seems less, it's harder to make a case that this is pressingly urgent in that same way. So if it goes through ordinary court processes, I mean, this could still very well be going a year or two from now. And Trump's probably not going to actually, like, building the wall will not happen until this is resolved. So, yeah, so it's kind of, you know, it's this big thing that's going to happen, but then there's just going to be this long, dragging court battle. And, you know, by the time it gets resolved, you know, we could be past 2020.
Right. And I'll also say that while we have heard that Donald Trump plans to declare a national emergency, we still don't know exactly what the rationale is going to be, where the money is going to come from, how big or what kind of a wall he is going to try to build based on this national emergency.
A beautiful one.
There you go. So there are still a lot of questions up in the air. We are going to keep this conversation purposefully short because we're still getting more information. We may be back with you tomorrow once we know more. And with that, we are going to move on to our conversation with Dara Lind. But before we do that, Nate, thank you.
Thank you.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
And Amelia, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
All right, let's continue on to the conversation that I mentioned earlier about this border security deal that Democrats and Republicans reached. Earlier today, I talked to Dara Lind of Vox.com. She's an immigration reporter and senior correspondent there. And I talked to her about this border security deal that's part of the bigger funding deal that would prevent a government shutdown on Friday at midnight. The key parts of the border security deal involve the amount of money allocated for building a wall or barrier or whatever you want to call it at the southern border, and the level of funding for the detention of immigrants by Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. I began by asking Dara whether or not she thought that Congress would pass this bill and whether it would be signed by President Trump.
You're asking me to predict what Donald Trump is going to do, and that is not a situation that any person should be put into. I've been kind of surprised that there haven't been more of the will he or won't he drama. You know, there haven't been more hissy fits on his part. I think a lot of people have forgotten because it's been overshadowed by the drama over the actual shutdown in January. But the last time President Trump signed a funding bill properly in March of 2018, he tweeted that morning that he was not necessarily going to sign it. He created a lot of uncertainty and drama and forced everyone basically to tune in to the bill signing ceremony to find out whether he was going to sign it or not. So I've been a little surprised that there hasn't been more of that, but never say never.
So what are the main contours of this border security deal?
The first point is, as you mentioned, the wall, quote unquote, or like the building of physical barriers on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Yeah, what are we calling it? I don't understand this debate over what we even call this thing. What should we call it?
Oh, my gosh. I think that the last couple of weeks have really shown that there's no agreement between anybody over what counts as not only the wall, but Trump's wall. That is just, it's been a semantic debate for 2 years. If anything, it's getting less well-defined. What is actually being built in a literal sense, or what is authorized by this bill, is 55 miles of what's called bollard fencing. Those are, you know, steel poles that are close enough to each other that nobody can get through them, but they're far enough apart that agents can see through to what's on the other side. That's the, you know, invisible wall or see-through wall that Trump started talking about in 2017 and that a lot of people made fun of because they didn't understand. That's an existing design that's been in use. It's kind of the best practice design for border barriers. And that's what they're continuing to build. So there's definitely, I think, a bit of a dunk impulse among Democrats to say, that's not a wall, that's a fence. It looks like a fence. It's like, it's not really something that you see between houses either. It's, you know, really kind of its own sort of barrier. I think barrier is the best way to describe it because it avoids this whole stupid thing. The Trump administration has called this construction a wall in the past. It has also, though, you know, made it seem like a big concession that they're not asking for a concrete wall anymore, even though that's not what they actually insisted Congress fund them for. So there's a lot of, I think, angst on both sides around the idea of giving Trump what he wants for the wall that turned out to be kind of irrelevant to what Congress was actually willing to fund, because it turns out everyone kind of agrees that if you're going to build a physical barrier, it should be bollard fencing.
I interrupted you a little bit there, but we were talking about the contours of the deal. So how much money is there for this bollard fencing?
So $1.375 billion for 55 miles in the Rio Grande Valley. And that would be, that's an area that doesn't currently have fencing there. So while one of the things that Democrats had said in the past was, well, we're not giving him any money to construct new fencing, this would in fact be there. There is, however, a restriction on where barriers can be built. There are, you know, nature preserves and other protected areas where it can't be. It does explicitly say that it's supposed to be based on existing models, not the new prototypes that the Trump administration tested in late 2017 and then kind of quietly backburnered because they didn't work very well. So kind of that's the first major plank. The second thing that wasn't the cause of the first shutdown but did kind of come up in the debates that congressional appropriators have been having over the last couple of weeks as they've tried to come to a deal, as you mentioned, is immigration detention. The Trump administration has been detaining a lot more people than they've been funded for. They've been running out their budget and then either getting money from other places or asking Congress to kind of fill in the gap. So this deal ostensibly funds them for less than they currently have, tries to get them to bring down the population in detention by the end of the fiscal year to stay in budget. But to do that, it funds an average of 45,000 or so, a little more than 45,000, as an average daily population in detention from now until September 30th, which is a big increase from last year's bill, which funded an average population of about 40,000. So that's, in a way, a big concession from Democrats, especially because some Democrats had wanted to put a hard cap on the number of people who could be detained at any given time who had been arrested in the U.S. But it, in theory, is supposed to bring them to a point where ICE is detaining about 40,000 people by the end of the fiscal year, so that it's shrinking the population from what is now about 49,000 to about 40,000.
I want to get a little bit more into the details of what the goals are with regard to bed numbers and detention limits. Mm-hmm. But before we get into that, or even the specifics of the wall, I just want to ask bluntly, like, what problems does this deal solve and what problems doesn't it solve?
I mean, it keeps the government open, right? And
okay.
Furthermore, is a more complete deal than a just, you know, another continuing resolution. It's not exactly the same as passing, like, fully vetted full-year appropriations bills, but it is the way that Congress is supposed to be doing budgeting, you know, actually setting levels for various things rather than just punting it down the road and saying we're going to continue to fund at existing levels. You know, it's taken until almost halfway through the fiscal year, and there's no indication that future years are going to be less dysfunctional, especially because the administration was legally obligated to have submitted its budget to Congress for 2020 already, and it hasn't done that. But this is, you know, a more functional way for Congress to operate than the way it's been operating for the last few months. Corollary to that, federal workers, assuming the bill gets signed, you know, big asterisk there, but if they are not dealing with yet another lapsed paycheck after the fairly ruinous financial situation that a lot of them were put in January, that's a very good thing for them. It doesn't really solve the kind of ongoing fight over what Trump expects of Congress, especially as regards the wall and what Congress is willing to give him. It doesn't address any immigration policy issues one way or the other, which both the Trump administration and congressional Democrats have tried to in the past use immigration funding fights to change immigration policy one way or the other. This doesn't do any of that. So we can expect there to be kind of continued debates about that. And there's the full text of this bill, which is over 1,000 pages, dropped late last night. Both chambers are expected to vote on it today. The president would have to sign it by tomorrow. There's quite possibly some stuff in here that we don't know, that, you know, hasn't been brought to public attention, that would be a problem, or that it doesn't really address issues that, you know, appropriators were trying to address. And because this is just such a rushed process, there are a lot of unknown unknowns here.
So we're calling this a border security deal. But in terms of immigration policy and addressing any problems that Democrats or Republicans see at the border, how much is contained in this bill?
There's some. Whether it's enough is a really good question, because the administration, in its demands to Congress during the shutdown, was making very hardline demands on expanding immigration enforcement and also some demands on expanding funding and capacity in a way that was not necessarily for the purpose of arresting and detaining more immigrants. So they had some money that they were asking for to increase, you know, vehicle screening at ports of entry, for example. They had money that they were asking for quote unquote humanitarian purposes. What that actually means in practice is money for Customs and Border Protection to create better conditions for children and families, because they're now dealing with a lot of those. Over half of people who were apprehended by Border Patrol agents in the last couple of months have been children and families. And you know, the deaths of two children in Customs and Border Protection custody were an illustration of just how inadequate the current policies and resources for dealing with them are. So this bill does have some of that. It, gives the Trump administration a little over half of what it was asking for on the humanitarian side. And it gives more money for capacity at ports of entry, you know, more money for vehicle screening, hiring new customs agents. So to a certain extent, the border crisis as Democrats would define it, you know, the kind of humanitarian issues of having poor conditions for children and families, there's a little bit there. It's really not clear whether that's going to be enough, because $800 million wasn't a ton for the administration to be asking for to begin with, certainly compared to its other demands, and they're getting a little over half of that. The administration's line on the crisis is that it's the fault of current asylum policy, that they need to be able to detain people, even families, for as long as it takes for their cases to get resolved before they get deported, that there shouldn't be, you know, separate treatment for families versus single adults, that it should be easier to return unaccompanied kids from Central America back to Central America without having to give them full court proceedings, that there's too low a standard for allowing somebody to stay in the U.S. and apply for asylum, that that screening interview needs to be made more rigorous. Those are things that they've all asked Congress to change as a condition of, you know, funding deals in the past. Those asks aren't in this bill. So from the administration's perspective, this does very little to address what they have identified as the crisis as it currently exists. The only thing that they're really getting is border barriers. And despite what the president says about the wall being the only solution to the crisis as he sees it, those won't go up for a couple of years yet. So it's not exactly clear how the money for 55 miles of barriers is going to stop people from coming in over the next couple of weeks.
Who decides how that money for the wall gets spent? They can now build 55 miles. Who gets to decide where it goes exactly, when it gets built, whether or not they can put more money into that fund potentially from other agencies and try to broaden that barrier a little bit more? How does this all work from here?
Right. So you're kind of getting into a much bigger question when it comes to what the administration can do to add more money to build the wall. As far as what is in that bill, the $55 billion, Congress is requiring Customs and Border Protection to give them a written plan of how they're going to spend that money before the money gets released. That doesn't appear to be a huge lift. This is actually very frustrating for me as a reporter, because I know, and everybody else who's reporting on this beat knows, that Congress actually has an annual, like, border security strategic plan that has been given to them by the administration. And it's a confidential document, so we, the press, can't see it, but Congress has it. And so hearing Congress say things like, well, we don't know why it's so important for the administration to have this border barrier, the administration says, well, it's in the document we gave you, and we, the press, can't determine whether or not that's true. So I don't know if – I actually am not sure if this – written plan that they're requiring now is going to be public or not, but there, you know, in theory is going to be a little more congressional oversight over how that billion gets spent. When we're talking about other monies that can be spent, though, and it is monies, by the way, because when you're talking about money from various funds, like, those count as discrete monies, that is a totally different animal, because Congress can put all the conditions it wants on no money appropriated through this bill can be used for XYZ. But when we're talking about other funds that can be used, it gets a lot murkier. So the administration has the authority to use, you know, a certain amount of discretion in moving money around, especially within departments and within agencies, but even kind of between departments, or, you know, using DOD money for DHS projects, essentially, by saying that there's some kind of, you know, defense interest. Some of the reports going around about the administration contemplating executive action on this say that the logic here would be that because there are currently active duty troops at the border, building a border barrier would be necessary to protect those troops, which I hope was more of a brainstorming idea than something they're actually going to commit to paper, because that's not the strongest logic in the world. But there's really broad executive authority to do a lot of this stuff. And so, you know, what exact authority the president would use, and whether it would require an emergency declaration or whether he could just do it through straightforward executive action, like, there are a lot of possibilities here. And I don't know that we're actually going to know the full universe of what is possible or being considered until it happens, especially if it happens simultaneously with the president signing this bill.
Right. So Trump World has been saying, this is a start. We got some money from Congress. But remember, there are all these different kinds of things that we can do. They are correct. And they could pull money from elsewhere or at least try and expand beyond the 55 miles.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are questions about whether they're going to decide that's the best use of their funds. Like, some of the reports indicate that they've identified Army Corps of Engineers projects in California to deal with wildfire relief and in Puerto Rico as things that they could easily take money from. That seems plausible. Like, I'm not sure that anyone in the White House is going to go, oh, gee, California really needs our help. Whether or not they should is a separate question, but we've definitely seen that the attitude of this White House toward both California and Puerto Rico is that the federal government should not be giving them more money. But on some of this stuff, like, you can't be using the exact same money within DHS for building the wall and for expanding ICE detention. So if push comes to shove, I don't think we're going to see literally every dollar that could hypothetically be dedicated to building border barriers dedicated that way, just because there are other things that they're going to want to do.
Got it. And so on the topic of ICE detentions, this was a sticking point in these negotiations. How many beds should the budget fund for ICE to detain immigrants? Democrats wanted to limit the number of beds. Why exactly?
There are more immigrants being held in detention now than there ever have been. And there are two big reasons for this. One is that a lot of the people who are coming into the U.S. can't immediately be deported. They are people who are families or they're asylum seekers. They're people who are staying in the U.S. for a certain amount of time to pursue, you know, some kind of legal claim. So that's increasing the number of people who are in detention, because when you're apprehended, you are then turned over to ICE, which in some cases is obligated by law to detain you. And in other cases, there's kind of a discretionary, how likely is this person to try to flee? The other thing that is a stream into ICE detention is arrests made of unauthorized immigrants or people who are suspected to be unauthorized immigrants in the interior of the United States. And ICE has been arresting more people than were arrested in the later years of the Obama administration, but it's been choosing to keep way more of those people detained. The presumption of this administration is detention unless proven otherwise, essentially. It's a default, and there's a lot less discretion available on a case-by-case basis to, like, is this person really a flight risk? Should we allow this person to get bond? A lot more people are requesting bond hearings in immigration court, but judges aren't granting them at any higher of a rate. So, you know, those two inputs have both resulted in this super high population. What Democrats were seeking to do in capping, there were kind of two different lines of thought here. One is, if you fund ICE for way fewer beds, even if they're going to move some money around, you know, that's going to be 35,000 beds plus whatever money they can move around rather than 45,000. Like, that means that the ceiling is much lower. The other thing that was being floated was a specific statutory cap on how many people could be held who had been arrested by ICE. In other words, people who had been in the United States who were being apprehended, you know, at home or after getting released from jail or going about their daily lives. The logic there was that, okay, yeah, you can't necessarily control who comes into the U.S. And sure, you do need some flexibility to be able to pick those people up from Border Patrol and detain them, but you do you have a lot of discretion on whether you're arresting people, and you have a lot of discretion about whether you are keeping all of those people in detention. So it was a way to kind of force ICE to be a little more judicious in who it really needed to keep in detention and who it was just putting there as a way to get their cases through more quickly.
So the number they landed on, they didn't land on an exact cap ultimately for people who are picked up in the interior.
No, they didn't. ICE has, in theory, all of the discretion in the world. If it wanted to, it could be a lot more aggressive in releasing immigrants who had been apprehended crossing into the U.S. in order to make more space for people, most of whom are being taken from jails or, you know, do have a criminal conviction or charge. Like, the Trump administration's argument is that if you have any kind of criminal history, that you are de facto a threat to public safety. And so it's very important that you remain detained. Congress has actually laid down in law that there are certain convictions that if you have them, you have to be kept in immigration detention. You can't be released. The Trump administration is going way above and beyond that, right? It's saying that any criminal conviction or charge is an equal amount of liability. So they do have some discretion there, but it doesn't look like they're likely to exercise it, right? They were extremely upset on Monday when it looked like there was a possibility that Congress was going to force them to have to release some people who had been charged with some kind of crime.
Congress now, if this gets passed and signed into law, will be funding 45,000 beds in ICE detention through September. And, you know, that's a higher funding level than it's been in the past. It seems like another way to deal with this issue is to process asylum claims or deportations more quickly. Is there anything in this deal that addresses that?
There is some. There's more hiring money for immigration judges, which is something that, after having been ignored by Congress for a while, Congress has really been throwing money at over the last few years. And there has been a lot of hiring of immigration judges by the Trump administration. That is less something that Congress can really force to happen more quickly than it is. Well, I mean, they can, you know, they're doing what they can, which is more hiring. The administration, for its part, is putting a lot of pressure on judges to resolve cases more quickly, to the point that judges are extremely frustrated that they're not being given the latitude they need to do their jobs, especially because during the shutdown, they had to delay a bunch of cases that were supposed to have hearings. That's kind of the one thing in there that's really changing efficiency.
All right. So when it comes to summing up what we have in this deal, it sounds like on both the wall and on detentions, there's a general agreement, but still the executive has a decent amount of room to move funds around potentially. And we'll see that there could be a fight playing out over how much discretion the executive actually has on either of these things.
Yeah, we'll see. Immigration is really an area where it's difficult to overstate how much latitude the administration has as a matter of law. There have been, you know, more efforts to restrain that in the courts under this administration than there had been previously. And I think we're now going to see how aggressive Congress wants to be and can be in terms of looking at immigration enforcement in a really intensive way from its end.
So that's this deal. And then when it comes to broader issues of an increase in number of families and children at the border, asylum seekers, et cetera, it sounds like that's for another day. Is there any interest in addressing that issue further now?
The problem is just that Democrats and Republicans totally disagree on what the issue is, right? To the extent that there is agreement that there's an urgent problem now, some of the funding there that is in this bill on the humanitarian stuff is kind of as bipartisan as you can get. But beyond that, Democrats fundamentally disagree that there need to be changes to asylum law to make it harder for families to come to seek and get asylum. Republicans fundamentally disagree that it's a good thing that these children and families are coming in. You know, they point to the relatively low success rate of asylum cases ultimately. They point to the, you know, there's a lot of fighting over to what extent people not showing up for court cases is a widespread problem, to what extent it's deliberate. And there's also, I think, because Donald Trump is so insistent in painting the border as a lawless place that is full of criminals, there's been a little reticence among Democrats in even talking about the border as an urgent issue that needs to be solved at all, because to do that would be seen as playing into Trump's hands. So I don't think we're going to get anywhere on this, in part because it's not really a, you know, it's not really a policy issue. It's a question of what is the problem here that needs to be addressed. And between partisan disagreement about whether the problem being the people or what the government is doing to the people, and then the president over there in his own little world talking about, you know, women being taped up in the backs of trucks, there isn't really the kind of consensus around the problem that you're trying to solve that you would expect to precede any kind of legislative fix.
Given that, is there a way to judge kind of who came out on top here? I know we've had a policy-heavy conversation. Now let's make it really petty and political. Is there a way of judging who came out on top here, Democrats or Republicans?
So I think the actual reason that it's hard to do that is because who knows what, like, there's totally a world in which this doesn't actually pass, right? That it's possible that the president gets cold feet or that House conservatives manage to get enough defections that they can insist on a two-week continuing resolution instead. Like, because we don't know for sure what the final deal is, it's a little premature to declare any victors. But I think if it does pass, the most obvious winner are going to be congressional Republicans who actually, you know, didn't wait for the president to pre-sign off on things before they wrote a deal. They negotiated first and then tried to figure out, you know, whether the president would sign it or not. And if they can actually get him to sign it, that is a big shift in the power dynamic from what we saw in the first 2 years.
Are there currently clear divides within either the Democratic or Republican Party on this bill?
Yeah, there's definitely some disappointment among progressives on some of the immigration stuff. I mean, a group of progressive freshmen led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put out a letter a couple of weeks ago saying there should be no new, you know, there should be no expansions to the ICE or CBP budgets. That money should be cut because what they're doing is inhumane. That is not what is happening in this bill. And while some of the money that is spent are to things that, you know, plenty of the money is not going to things that are going to directly arrest immigrants, the kind of top line, no new money or, you know, reduce existing funds is very far apart from where the actual bill is. So there's going to be some defection there. Conservatives just don't believe that the president got enough of what he wanted, right? That $1.375 billion is not $5 billion. And there is, I think, a little bit of frustration among House conservatives that is not shared by the White House over what, you know, the idea of steel bollards as a wall. I think they're a little bit further from the kind of operational demands of Border Patrol agents than the White House is on that. So like there's some insistence there that it would be better to just do a 2 week continuing resolution and then kind of try to fix the bill from there. There's also, I think, a little bit of Republican frustration with the idea of voting on a 1,000-plus page bill that you only have a day to read out. Yeah. It seems very swampy. But those are kind of the splits that we're seeing right now, you know, with the major asterisk that when there's so little time to look over one of these, something could come up at the last minute and become a sticking point. You know, even over the last few days, we saw detention become a sticking point. We saw disaster funding become a sticking point. We saw pay for federal contractors, back pay from the shutdown become a sticking point. Reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act was something that it looked like was going to derail the bill for a second. So when you're trying to fund 9 federal departments and a bunch of other agencies at once, a lot of things can come up as flashpoints.
Is this something that Democrats running for president in 2020 can support?
That's a very good question. I mean, I don't know about can support. I have generally been surprised at both the extent to which Democrats have been running to the left on immigration and the fact that there's a really robust policy debate happening within the Democratic primary field on other issues and not on immigration. It's been something that has kind of been pointed to in campaign speeches, but doesn't have the kind of sink your teeth into them proposals that the anti-poverty plans have or that the kind of debate over the Green New Deal. So I can see this becoming an issue where Democrats, you know, given how many Senate Democrats are running for president, where on the debate stage, presidential candidates are asked to justify their votes for or against this bill, and you'll have people on each side justifying them one way or the other. But, you know, I don't think it's going to become a litmus test for anybody. I certainly, you know, I think if it does become a litmus test in the presidential primary, it'll be a sign of how anemic the immigration debate would be among Democrats. Because really, if you're talking about this particular bill as opposed to what you would actually do or any new proposals you have, then, you know, that's not ideal.
So there's not a sense that any Senate Democrat voting for even just $1.375 billion in barrier extensions would be detrimental to a campaign that's running on the left.
I think there are definitely people on the left who want to make it a problem for Democrats, who want to capitalize on the aversion to Trump and get Democrats away from the position where they were in before Trump was elected, which was, we can throw whatever money at border security. That's an easy bipartisan win for us because nobody cares. People do care now. The question is what kind of power those people have in the Democratic Party and whether that is enough of a thing for them that it's going to overshadow other issues on immigration.
All right. Well, we will see how this plays out. Dara, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Dara Lind covers immigration at Vox.com and also co-hosts the podcast The Weeds. If you aren't familiar with it, go check it out. That's it for now. My name is Galen Druk. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments you might have. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you on Monday.